that's got shall have, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own. That's got his own.
Very much so. Very much so indeed. That's Billie Holiday with God Bless the Child, a signature song of hers. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's Thursday, July the 25th. And we'll be talking with a very honored guest, Dr. Algernon Austin from the Washington, D.C.-based Economic Policy Institute. We'll be taking a look at the fact that 50 years on August, I believe the 28th, that's correct, August the 28th will be 50 years since the Great March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. And we'll tackle the first part of that two-pronged effort, talking about the state of affairs with respect to jobs, not just today, but in the 50 intervening years. So thank you so much, Dr. Austin, for being with us today. Is it there?
Hello?
Okay.
Thank Hi. You. Can you hear
Welcome.
Me?
Yes, I can now, yes.
Okay,
Thank
yes.
you for being
Pleasure
with us
to
today.
Be with you.
Well, you paint a grim picture of what the 50 intervening years between the March on Washington, the historic march where 200,000 plus people showed up on the mall, urged on by a coalition of civil rights, human rights, labor rights activists, and the task was to bring attention to the nation, to the government, about the dire straits that the country was in then. How has the country fared since then to now?
Well, we have not done well. One of the key demands of the march, it was called the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom because one of the most important demands was for jobs. The activists called for a national program that would provide a job to everyone who wanted to work, a full employment program. And we are 50 years later, we're still waiting for that to happen. In that respect, we've done poorly because, you know, the priority to create jobs and to see that Americans are employed has not been pursued, has not been kept. Unfortunately, today the picture is worse than ever because, one, we went through the Great Recession, the worst economic downturn that we've seen since World War II. And we're still suffering with high unemployment. Unfortunately, the folks in Congress are paying no attention. If anything, they're trying to push policies that would worsen the job situation by laying off government workers, by cutting food stamps that would help stimulate the economy. So they're going in completely in the wrong direction. So that's one thing. The other important economic demand was for a living wage, a wage that someone can support a family. Unfortunately, today, our minimum wage is worth less today in 2013 than it, in real terms, in terms of its real purchasing power, our minimum wage today is worth less than it was in 1963. The minimum wage today is about $2 less than it was in 1968. So we've been moving backward on that, backwards on that front also. So it's really, you know, the civil rights activists and the labor activists accomplished much on that day 50 years ago, but in some respects, we're worse off today than we were then.
Well, could you tell us about the specific characteristics of the economy today and why it troubles you? What is it about the economy today, how it's structured, that should give people pause to think about what's the capacity of government to impact on these structural problems?
Right. Well, there have been several changes in the economy over time, and an extremely important one was the decline of labor unions. The United Auto Workers were one of the sponsors of the March in Washington, and there are a number of other unions that were there. A. Philip Randolph, the person who spearheaded the March in Washington, whose idea was the real leader. He was the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters Union, the first all-black union, and he was a very important labor and civil rights leader in the 1940s and 1950s and 1960s. So the union presence was really crucial to the March in Washington. And if you look at the sort of income growth over the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, you saw that when the economy grew, everyone benefited. I mean, people who were the poorest workers saw increases in wages, and the richest workers saw increases in wages. Since the 70s, we've been seeing declines in the strength of unions, and since the 70s, we've also seen a situation where the economy grows, the richest workers see increases in income, the middle workers see very little, and some of the poorest workers see declines in their earnings in real terms. So we have an economy now that where the economic growth is extremely unequal, and there are a number of factors that's behind this. But one real important factor for the reason why more than half of men today are earning less than they would have earned 30 years ago is because of the decline of unions.
Well, you are the director of the program on race, ethnicity, and the economy at the Economic Policy Institute. And in this respect, you pay particular attention to the factor of race. And I've been reading your reports, and you keep pointing to the fact that we have now an absolute permanent underclass, it seems, and it is race-based. How did this happen?
Unfortunately, you know, this country has been wrestling with race since its inception. And in some respects, and in important respects, we've made progress. Important respects, you know, if you look today compared to the 50 years ago, it's important to acknowledge the progress. I mean, the occupations, you know, someone with a college degree, for example, who's black in 1960, would have a very hard time getting a white collar job. You know, I mentioned the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters Union. That was actually one of the best jobs that a black man could get at that time, regardless of what level of education that he had. So it's true today that in terms of occupations, really the entire spectrum, you know, up to the White House, the entire range of occupations are open to black men. Well, for the White House, it's certainly just males, but black women also have tremendous occupational opportunities today that they didn't have in the 1963. However, while that is the case, we continue to see that employers give preference to white workers over black workers. And we've seen this, we see this in a number of ways. Perhaps the most, one of the more compelling ways is, that researchers have documented this is that they've sent out resumes of the resumes have the same qualifications, but one resume will have the name Lakeisha or Jamal on it. And then the same resume will be sent out, but instead of Lakeisha and Jamal, it will have a name Emily or Greg on it. And what researchers find is that just that difference, if you just change Lakeisha to Emily, the likelihood that an employer calls that person for an interview goes up significantly. So having the name Emily as opposed to Lakeisha improves your chances. And of course, it's not the name per se. It's the fact that people named Lakeisha and Jamal in the United States are much more likely to be black than white. And people have done similar studies using actual individuals, not just resumes, but they've sent out testers, they're called, to apply for jobs, fill out job applications. And in city after city, researchers find that the black applicant is less likely to be given a call back for an interview, less likely to be offered a job, even though on the application they're presenting the same qualifications as a similar white applicant. So for this reason, this is one of the reasons why in the labor market we see much higher and actually quite extremely high black unemployment, and we've seen that for the entire 50-year period. In the 50-year period, the highest white unemployment corresponds to about the very lowest blacks have seen in terms of the unemployment rate. So there remains a severe disparity in terms of the opportunity to get a job. In addition, you know, and I talk about this in the overview paper that's available at theunfinishedmarch.com, we still have an educational system that's biased against blacks. You know, black children still go to schools that are separate and unequal. Blacks are still concentrated in neighborhoods that are separate and unequal. And this disadvantage in schooling, this disadvantage in terms of neighborhood resources and disadvantages in the labor market, all of these things mean that blacks are going to be overrepresented in poverty and in the most disadvantaged situations relative to the rest of the American public.
Our president is on the road pushing his economic program, whatever that turns out to be. You've had an opportunity to observe President Obama's administration's policies for 5 years now. To what degree do you see that those policies have either helped or hurt progress on these fronts that you're discussing?
Well, they have helped in the extent that they've prevented things from being much worse than they could have been. So I mentioned that we've the recession that technically started in the end of 2007 and technically ended in the middle of 2009, that was the biggest downturn that we've seen since the Great Depression. And the Recovery Act and other proposals that the Obama administration has put in place has really helped to prevent that from doing all of the damage that it could. You know, it's important that there were stimulus efforts to create jobs. It's important that there was additional aid to low-income people who are more likely to lose jobs and to more likely to have difficulties paying for basic necessities. So there are important things like expansions of the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit Extensions of unemployment insurance. Those things helped African Americans as well as low-income people broadly significantly. However, the American Jobs Act, there are a number of, was never fully implemented. So Congress has really, and this is, goes back to what I was saying, that we have people in Congress who are actively working to stop job creation in a period of high unemployment. And with the American Jobs Act, they did precisely that. There were good proposals to continue to create jobs, to continue to help speed up the recovery, but people in Congress opposed that. So the administration has done well to a degree. You know, the proposals are not as big and as bold as they should be. Even the Recovery Act, about a third of the Recovery Act was tax cuts. No one talks about that. But it's not clear to me that what President Obama has proposed has been big enough and bold enough to really address the crisis that we unfortunately are still struggling through. However, you know, even if he only proposed something that was, you know, a third of what was actually necessary, he's had to deal with the Congress who have really blocked his policies from even having their full effect. So it's a mixed story. He could have done more, and his opposition has certainly weakened even his less than robust efforts.
But at the same time, the president makes it very clear that his focus is on the, quote, middle class, unquote. In fact, that's the whole theme he has been running on with respect to his economic policies. So is it likely that we will continue? Is the president, in your view, practicing class warfare?
Oh, I wouldn't say he's practicing class warfare. I think he's being a politician who is following, trying to be as centrist as he possibly can. The idea of, you know, working to improve the middle class, that's something that whether we like it or not, appeals to many Americans. You know, so that's something that that's a way to talk and to think about and to approach issues that can try to get a large section of the middle. Now, again, I mentioned that there is a class warfare going on, and as Warren Buffett said, his class is winning. So what we need from a president really is someone who will champion the people who are not in Warren Buffett's class and income bracket. So we do need there are policies that we can pursue that will directly help lower income individuals and also, you know, help the middle and even bring some benefit, help sustain even some of the wealthy. But unfortunately, President Obama is a centrist politician, so he's not going to, and he has not been a real champion of the policies needed to rebalance the American economy in a time when the rich continue to get richer and amass more and more political power.
from your vantage point, I know you have to go shortly, but from your vantage point, what would you say are the top imperatives at this time to correct the stark imbalances in the economy?
Oh, that's there are so many things.
Pick your top two.
Okay, or maybe four. Well,
okay,
one thing that we should do, and I mentioned the March in Washington, they called for a higher minimum wage. One thing that's easy, you know, the majority of the American public right now supports raising the minimum wage. The minimum wage should be raised to Representative George Miller, I believe, has a bill to raise it to a little over $10. That should be done, and it should be, you know, at the very least indexed to inflation so that it's not allowed to erode in value over time. I mentioned before, today in real purchasing power terms, we've let our minimum wage erode so that it's less than what it was in 1963. We should, at minimum, lift it up to about $10 an hour and index it to inflation. That's at minimum. We also need to invest in infrastructure. Our infrastructure has a D-plus rating. That's a excellent sort of way to stimulate the economy, put a lot of people back to work. And once you have strong infrastructure, that helps future productivity. So it helps the current jobs crisis now, and it helps ensure economic activity going forward. A financial transactions tax would be great. A major portion of the blame for the sort of the housing bubble and the deep crash that the economy went into with the Great Recession was due to the financial sector. We can put a small tax, you know, a fraction of 1% on certain trades. And that would help rebalance the economy. One, it would reduce some of the crazy things that are going on Wall Street, and also it will help recapture some of the wealth that Wall Street really sort of sucked out of many communities and put it back to the benefit of Main Street. So that's three, but again, there are many other things. You know, I mentioned the importance of unions. It's important to create a climate where unions can grow and help, again, help see that Main Street shares in prosperity, not just Wall Street.
Well, Dr. Algernon Austin, thank you so much for joining us today and giving us this briefing. And we'll come back. And you'll do something far more detailed, not that you didn't today. You know, you did quite well today, I must say. Thank you. But we'll take on the subject because I know this is an area that is of great interest to you, and you've spent many, many years studying the lopsided economy and the impact it has on people, particularly people who are just not within the circles of power. So thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. I look forward to talking again.
Thanks again. Well, thank you. We'll take a break and then come right back right after these messages about great programs here at PRN.FM.
Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own. That's got his own. Lots of friends, they're crowding round your door, but when you're gone and spending ends, they don't come no more.
That's great lesson in song with Billie Holiday's God Bless the Child. You're listening to Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And now the flip side of the discussion that turns to you. We just heard an analysis, an overview, really. It was not as detailed as we're going to get in the future, but it was enough to get the conversation started about the stark differences between wealth and poverty in the United States. It's really awful, something that I've been talking about here for quite some time. From your sense of things, where you are in life, wherever that happens to be, the place from which you can observe things and combine it with your own personal experiences, what would you say are some of the major factors that might have contributed to a 50-year drought, if you will, of progress in making the playing field a little bit more equal than it is? And do you think that the Obama administration has been responding appropriately to the yawning gap between those who are rich and those who are poor? Your thoughts about these things at 888-874-4888. What factor or factors would you identify? Just pick one so that you could, you know, get some solid, a body of solid reaction. What major factor would you say, from your own vantage point, from your own way of thinking, your own direct experience, would you say has contributed more than anything else to the decline of the American economy and the increase in hardship for many, many millions of Americans today? And is the Obama administration, in your view, has it responded appropriately to the pressing need for action? Does it have, in your view, a credible response? Does it outline a plan where you can see that by implementing it, the circumstances will change for the vast majority of people who are really hurting in this country? I'm really interested in your observations and analysis at that point. On that point, 888-874-4888. Who will be the first contestant? Let's hear you with your analysis. You know, the thing is that it's one thing to hear, of course, the experts, and they have a handle on this. They've been studying these areas, many of them exclusively these things. They've been studying for years and years and years. But it is another thing to find out how a theoretical issue literally translates at ground level. How does it impact people? When the discussion of the economy takes place, how does that resonate with you? What do you experience as the economy? What does it mean to you? Do you recognize your role in it? Are you somehow affected by it? Or do you just have an entirely different approach to this thing, this amorphous concept called the economy? But certainly you are in a position to have noticed that there's something dramatically wrong. And if it is the view of people like Dr. Algernon Austin that there has been a creeping move toward progress here and a creeping move toward progress there, but 50 years have gone by. That's half a century has gone by. And here we are. Exactly, in fact, not exactly, we're worse off, is what he says in many ways, than we were 50 years ago. How did this happen? And how do we get out of it? That is an extraordinary thing for a country known all over the world, the only country, as is pointed out to us here, the only country that calls itself a superpower. So what has to happen? What did happen to create this fissure in our economy? 888-874-4888. That's the number, 888-874-4888. The president, of course, is on those on the road. He's touting this economy, and it's very nicely timed too, because now it's year five, and it's the eve of the election process. And on the basis of the economy, many voters will be making a decision as to which party they vote for, if they vote at all. So we will see the revitalization of programs that should appeal to a broad constituency. But does it trouble you about this, the way the president continues to hammer home about the idea that if you take care of the, quote, middle class, unquote, everybody benefits, the vast majority of working class and working poor people and unemployed people even. It would benefit them. We're hearing now from Baltimore, the city of Baltimore. Green, you are on the air.
Hello, you trees.
Hello.
You know, it's always a pleasure to hear your show, and I'm disappointed when I can't listen to you and then I can't find you on TuneIn Radio. So whoever's responsible for getting your programs on, I wish they would make sure all of them get on.
Oh, but, I think they do a good job, but it's a good idea to always check. Thank you.
Okay. All right. You trees, you know, I think that, and I've said it before, and you've hit on it. I mean, you know, you've talked about it too. But the biggest problem that we have is fighting. The biggest problem we have is white supremacy, the idea of white supremacy. And as a result of the way that we've internalized it, because, you know, black people are white supremacists too. You know, we believe, whether we want to admit it or not, that white is superior. And that's not, I'm not saying that in condemnation of black folk. We don't have a lot of choice, because it's all we get from, you know, womb to the grave. And unless we get different information to combat that, then we're going to continue to be white supremacists. As a result of being white supremacists, believing in the superiority of white folk and the inferiority of black people, you know, we're demoralized people, we're timid people. We are often, as the Bible says, lacking in natural affection. And we certainly don't have affection for one another.
So are we good at just discussing an economic theory soon?
I know, and it gets to that, because as Dr. Welsing, you know, explained, white supremacy is taught and promoted in all areas of human activity, which means everything that a human being can do, and that one of those areas, as defined by sociologists, is economics. You know, we, as a collective, I'm talking about black people, not brown people or anybody else. You know, I'm an African. I'm concerned about my family. We have more buying power than most of the nations in the world. If we were not white supremacists, then we could see a way, because we're the most brilliant people on the planet, so that we could pool our resources and build our own economy independent of this economy, the greater economy, and we could provide jobs and health services and anything else that we need for our people. But as long as we continue to buy into this idea that we can't, because we're the most inferior people on the planet, then we can't do any of the things that we should do for ourselves that we're totally capable of doing.
So, in your view, a response to the condition, the actual condition at ground level for so many people of African descent in the United States, one of the solutions would be to return to literally the old days of being self-sufficient and constructing your own economy. Is that essentially what you're saying, right?
Yes, yes, I am. And I think that, you know, enough time has gone by. We've been in this country over 500 years. We've been living with these people who are totally crazy. And as a result of it, you know, we've suffered from mass insanity. It's been enough time for us to have collected evidence and come to a verdict. We have no part with these folks except to save them whenever they get in trouble. We need to take care of ourselves. We need to stop worrying about everybody else because they're okay. They've got their group together. And, you know, America's Claude Anderson described it as an environment of group competition. We're the only group that is no group.
Well, you raise a very serious question, and you make your point very clearly. Let's see who reacts to it. Thank you so much for contributing
well,
it today.
Thank you, Eutrice.
Thank you so much. Well, that's one solution, and of course, it is not unusual. Almost every ethnic group has exactly the same mindset that you construct your own parallel economies. There are people, for example, in Chinatown, they're not even worried about the outside of Chinatown. Everything, life is contained there. All their needs are met within the boundaries of a culture. So you see that in every single community, ethnic community, or any community that could be described as having a major thing in common. Gays do it. In fact, that's how gays have constructed one of the most powerful economic forces, simply operating on the basis of their oppression. If you are oppressed because of sexual orientation, it makes sense that you organize on the basis of sexual orientation. And that's exactly what they've done, and they've made great strides there. So every affected class has a similar kind of response as the saying goes, the basis on which you are oppressed is the basis on which you organize. So if it is race and racial disparities and racial hatred and racial ostracism, it makes sense that people would want to organize on that basis. It's not because anybody hates anybody. It's because it is literally a way of survival in a smart way, surviving smartly by keeping the money in the community. And we've had examples, by the way, of very thriving communities in Harlem, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the South. We had enclaves where we had African-American multimillionaires. In fact, in Oklahoma, we had, in the Depression, more African-American millionaires than in most any other part of the, not just the state, but of the country. So it's an interesting point to ponder. 888-874-4888. How does the economy resonate with you whenever that term is used, the economy, or whenever the president talks about his economic policies? How is it resonating with you? Are you part of this community that he's talking about? Have you lost faith in the American economic system? Have you yourself experienced a decline in your economic potential and in your economic stability? Have you begun to question why things are the way they are and what could be done to improve conditions? These are the questions. And of course, we know, as Greed pointed out, we have a society that actually was constructed on the basis of racial hatred. We can't escape it. And everybody's affected. If somebody tells you they're not, they're lying. Everybody's affected. And so part of the job of recovery, which is why I encourage open and sincere discussion, part of the job is to dispense with the idea of having to hold your tongue and, you know, saying what you feel, because these are very legitimate feelings, very legitimate. And it is the work that needs to be done if people subscribe and truly believe in the how could, for lack of a better term, the ideology of liberalism, if you want to put it that way, but that a progressive approach is you have to deal in a relationship that assumes equality in the power relationship. You know, not the traditional way of operating, that people are perfectly entitled to and, in fact, absolutely must devise their own solutions. And those solutions may not seem good to you, but, you know, it's too bad in a way because you're not experiencing the same things that others are experiencing, you see? When you walk in somebody else's shoes, you go, oh, I get it. I see it now. I understand. I understand. And before, you know, like before the major, most recent depression that we've had, the recession they're calling it, but it was a full-fledged depression, it served notice on a lot of people who thought they were very comfortable in life and had everything going for them, including their supremacy. Hello, you're on the air, Michael.
Oh, hi, Eutrice. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. Same here.
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking about this a little bit, too, and it just seems not only the economy, but almost in every sector of our society now, we live in it's sort of like a basically regressive society. With every once in a while, we have this surge of progressivism, you know, and I'm struggling with this word progressive also, mm-hmm. As to what it means, and someday maybe we'll define it because we call ourselves progressive or the progressive radio network, and sometime we should just, like, you know, dig into that word and see what it really means. And but the major thing is regression, as far as I could see. I mean, you have the New Deal. We have a surge of progressivism, the Great Society. We have the civil rights movement, the labor movement. These are great, great potentials, great movements. We have certain things in the economy like unemployment insurance that we would all call these factors progressive. I think we would agree. The civil rights movement, the civil rights laws, the anti-discrimination laws. And then these are like little movements, but then the great majority is this drag coming down that's against voting rights, for example, that diminishes the labor movement so that it almost doesn't exist anymore except in little segments of activity. And the economic security is being diminished day after day. The labor movement, of course, you know, we see there's very little labor movement left, and the action against voting rights and against you know, the voter IDs, these are all regressive kinds of things, and this is the dominant push, and to maintain any kind of progressive activity, you know, it requires a tremendous amount of human energy at the grassroots level, and people who take advantage of them, they seem to think that, you know, there's so many ways to divide these people, they'll never get a movement going, and they can just, you know, destruct it. In the meantime, the all the benefits, the cream floats to the top, and they're easily able to pass laws that give the banks tremendous advantages. I noticed today that the banks could borrow money at 0.75%, and the children who are trying to go to school and get a college education have to borrow money at 4.75%, going up to 6% and up and up and up. And this is just in the paper today. So, you know, here's the banks have this tremendous advantage, and the kids are being exploited, children.
You make a very good point about the sleeping. Let me just tack on to something that you said, and it's very significant, and we are going to get deeper into this discussion. It is that this march on Washington was actually proposed by A. Philip Randolph, who at the time was the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. Now, those are men who worked the trains going all over the country. What is significant about that is most of these men were actually very, very well educated. In fact, one of the most recent seniors, one of the more outstanding ones, was Percy Sutton, the chairman of the Inner City Broadcasting Corporation, and who was Manhattan Borough president and a very highly prominent person, one of the Tuskegee Airmen. But he had a law degree. And the only job that they could get was, you know, train conductor in the subway system of New York. So that there was an extraordinary lopsidedness. You had all this education because the demand was for education. And then you get it and you can't get a job commensurate with the education that you've had. So now today's youth, younger people, are experiencing the same thing. They're going to college and they're spending all this money in tuition and years in study, and they get out and there's nothing there. So the fact that 50 years ago, a union headed by, you know, essentially it was a black union, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, they were able to bring the country to understand this issue dramatically. And today, we don't find leadership like that. We really don't.
Yeah, I mean, this is a major drag on the economy, is because, you know, these huge imbalances and advantages that certain segments of the economy have, certain classes have in society, and it's a very small slice. You know, they allow money to go at advantaged rates and advantaged ways to certain segments, like in the health field, mm-hmm. health, certain areas of health and pharmaceuticals. The money is allowed to flow into those directions, and they're not allowed, you know, they're stifled flowing into other areas.
Well, I want to thank you, Michael, for your observations and your participation today. Thank you so much. Profound as usual. Thank you. Thank you. So we're getting close to the end of our program today, but it was a kind of getting our feet wet about a very uncomfortable conversation that we'll be pursuing. And inevitably, we will come to the question, are white liberals prepared to deal with anybody else on equal footing? That's the question we're leading up to. To what degree is political progress, affected by supremacy even within the ranks of liberals and progressives? What has to be done to overcome this? Can it be done? Should it be done? Or to what degree would struggles undertaken by others, as we saw with the Brotherhood of Union, the Brotherhood of Porters, Sleeping Car Porters, have we grown in 50 years? And the we, I'm speaking particularly to white America. Has white America grown any to the point of understanding the need for coalition building or for the common ideals that they share with others, the sense of community? Are they prepared to participate on equal footing? Or is it always, well, even though I'm liberal, I still can tell you what to do? Let's meet each other again tomorrow at the same time at 1 o'clock. And encourage people to drop by and get involved with PRN.FM, not only this program, although I'd love it to just be for my program, but there's so much happening here at PRN.FM. There's a lot that they can expose themselves to in the way of information. It's a great, great place, and I encourage you to encourage others to pay us a visit. So we'll come back to each other and this conversation, because it has to be had. We're dancing around it, but we want to examine whether within the liberal community we still have that omnipresence of racist thinking that disallows the community of playing a vital role in advocating for the broader good, because the liberal community, the progressive community, is behaving just like everybody else. You know, it's all about me, and as long as I'm okay, then we're all okay. We have to change that mindset, and the only way to do it is to confront it. So thank you so much for listening, and let's come back here joining each other again tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Thank you. Bye-bye.
The bread and set. You can help yourself, but don't take too much. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child.